most of us need some introduction, but maybe the simplest thing to say is that the whole of the modern approach to quantum gravity would not exist were it not for Abai's work. Abai, with the discovery of the new variables and many, many other discoveries and contributions, has really led the development of the modern theory of quantum gravity, and all the different approaches, not just with quantum gravity, have been energized and by his work and his approaches. It's very wonderful to have him with us. He's giving two talks. So tomorrow at 11, which is a non-standard time, he'll give a talk about why there is no singularity in black hole evaporation. So any of you who think there is a singularity, or who think they know the solution to the puzzle of black hole information, please come. That's at 11. And today he's talking to us about what we can learn about the cosmological singularity from simple models. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. It was supposed to be come last year, actually, and I got sick just the day before and had to postpone. I was told this is a colloquium, so it's really a speech at a colloquium level. I beg your pardon of those experts who might find this a little bit too. So the title is Quantum Nature of the Big Bang. There's a pedagogical review, which is available. And there's a slightly more technical review, which is also available, which has just appeared this week in the archives. And I just want to emphasize that this is not just my work, it's the work of a lot of people, particularly the people who are featured here, that I will be summarizing. So exactly 100 years ago, Hermann Minkowski told us that space and time should be fused into a four-dimensional continuum, the space-time continuum. And 7 years later, general relativity was born. And of course, the fundamental idea of general relativity that we all know is that there's a very beautiful encoding of gravity in the very geometry of the space-time. And because of that, geometry becomes a physical and dynamical entity. And of course, the most spectacular predictions and consequences of general relativity to cosmology, to black holes, and to gravitational waves rely on the fact that gravity is encoded in the very geometry of space-time. But this comes with a price, because now space-time itself ends at the singularities. The Big Bang represents the absolute beginning. And this is also true in the inflationary scenarios. I mean, the general singularity theorems, which tell us that there was actually a singularity at the beginning in the context of general relativity, if certain energy conditions are satisfied, these are typically not satisfied by the inflationary potentials that are often used. And so in the early days, there was a possibility that perhaps in the eternal inflation scenario, for example, there may not be a Big Bang singularity. But there are general theorems, more recent than the classical ones, due to Groot, Arvind Bourdain, Groot, and Levin, which tell us that even in the inflationary scenario, there is actually a Big Bang, and the space-time actually comes to an end. In particular, if you look at the assumptions of the spatial homogeneity and isotropy, then that implies that the metric has a Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker form, and the volume element goes as a cube, and the curvature goes as some negative power n, which depends on the form of matter that we have. And then Einstein's equation tells us that the volume goes to zero, that is an epoch, and the volume will actually go to zero. And of course, then the curvature blows up, and we get the Big Bang. And classically, then physics just stops, and space-time itself ends. And therefore, we think about Big Bang as the absolute beginning, as I said, also in the inflationary scenarios.
Pardon me, what was n, your exponent in the curvature?
It depends on the form of matter that we have, so it can be different for different forms of matter. So it's not just something dimensionally determined, because matter also provides a dimensional pool. So for example, this is a typical picture, an artist's conception of Big Bang. This is supposed to be a space-time which is expanding out. And over here, we've got a nice engineer, but at the beginning, space-time itself crumples, and that is where the fabric of space-time, something goes wrong, and you have got an initial singularity there. Now, however, there is a general expectation that this occurs because theory which is general relativity, is being pushed beyond its domain of applicability. Much before we hit the singularity, the curvature of space-time attains Planck state, and at that time, quantum effects should be not only important, but should dominate physics. And these are completely ignored in general relativity. And therefore, strictly, Big Bang is a prediction of general relativity precisely in the domain where it is not applicable. And therefore, even though in popular lectures and radio talk shows and so on, we always like to say the universe began 14 billion years ago with the Big Bang, we really have no reason to believe that, because this prediction is based on general relativity, which fails before the Big Bang is actually reached. And therefore, the idea is that quantum effects might make a big difference. An example is that of hydrogen atom. Classically, the Hamiltonian is bounded below, but unbounded from below in the classical Hamiltonian because of the 1 upon r potential. And there are instabilities. But we know that quantum effects come into play and raise the Gaussian energy from minus infinity to about minus 13.6 electron volts because of the phases of h bar in the denominator. And as far as h bar goes to 0, we get the classical result. But in nature, h bar is what it is. And therefore, the energy is actually bounded from below. And therefore, general expectation is that maybe something similar would happen. And the singularity of general relativity would be resolved by quantum gravity. So really, classical singularities of general relativity are excellent gates to physics beyond Einstein. And the goal of this talk is to show that in simple models, in fact, quantum physics does not stop at singularities. Quantum geometry extends life of physics, so to say, beyond the singularity. And one gets rather startling perspectives on the nature of space and time. The models we're going to discuss are very simple. But, say, for example, in contrast to what happens in standard string theory, they do encompass the physically most interesting singularities, the Big Bang, and the black hole singularities, for example, but I'm not going to talk about it today, tomorrow. And here, however, what I'll do is to focus on mainly conceptual and mathematical physics issues. I mean, there's only 1 hour. I cannot go into, for example, the main phenomenological applications, not indicated at the very end, nor can I go into some issues that many of you are very interested in, which are conceptual measurement questions, issues of measurement theory, decovalence, and so on and so forth. I'm really going to be focusing here mainly on these mathematical physics issues. So I'm going to use loop quantum gravity. I think audience here knows a little bit about that, at least. I mean, many of you are real experts, and so our students probably have heard about the basic ideas. The basic idea is to retain this duality between gravity and geometry of general relativity, but we want to encode new physics in quantum Riemannian geometry rather than in the classical Riemannian geometry as was done in general relativity. And this quantum Riemannian geometry was developed rigorously in the mid-1990s. We won't need all the details about this quantum Riemannian geometry, but that is the basic idea, that somehow this quantum Riemannian geometry makes a big difference and it extends physics beyond the singularities. And the organization of the talk is as follows. First, I'll talk about a little bit about conceptual setting, then about Friedman-Robertson-Walker models and older cosmology, and then quantum geometry and singularity resolution, and then summary. So let me set the stage by asking some general questions which don't refer to any particular theory of gravity. I'm delighted that Neil has to sit down because I've seen her.
Nobody will take the speech here. But I know this. Now
okay. So there are a bunch of questions which don't depend on an approach, but I think any approach to quantum gravity should address these questions. One question is, how close to the Big Bang does the smooth space-time of general relativity make sense? For example, the entire inflationary scenario is based on the assumption that we can use a space-time continuum, we can use gravity being described by general relativity plus matter. Can we justify this assumption at some first principle level? Is the Big Bang singularity naturally resolved in quantum gravity? And we'll see that in the simplest model that I want to discuss today, the answer is no in the Wheeler-DeWitt cosmology. And so the question is, whether quantum geometry makes a big difference here. Is there a new principle or a boundary condition in the Big Bang that is essential? For example, do we need to add something more to quantum Einstein's equation by hand, such as the celebrated Hart-Hawking boundary proposal? No boundary proposal. Is the quantum evolution across the singularity deterministic? So for example, you might have a pre-Big Bang branch, you might have a post-Big Bang branch, but are your equations such that you get a deterministic evolution as you evolve from the pre-Big Bang branch to the post-Big Bang branch? Such branches exist also in the pre-Big Bang model, in string theory, and also in abiotic and cyclic models. But typically, one uses their perturbative approaches, which uses the space-time continuum, and so strictly, the theory does not quite, the equations actually break down at the singularity itself. And so, therefore, so far, the answer is actually no. But as I indicated at the end of the talk, there are indications from loop quantum gravity that if you actually include quantum gravity corrections, then the cyclic and ekbaryotic scenarios, in fact, this particular limitation might be overcome. And then what is on the other side? If, in fact, there was a pre-Big Bang universe, what happened before the Big Bang? Was the quantum state of the universe just chaotic, just large quantum fluctuations? Was there just a space-time form, which in some sense condensed and gave rise to our space-time today that we see around us? Or was there, in fact, another large classical universe on the other side? So these are the questions that we want to ask in the context of quantum gravity. But already in the context of general relativity, these questions about was there something before the Big Bang have fascinated people. And Lemaître, Besitter, Tolman, Gamow, Gitti, Sakharov, and Weinberg, all these people have speculated what should happen. For example, George Gamow, most of these people thought that there should be, in fact, a pre-Big Bang branch. And particularly, Gamow thought that there should be just one pre-Big Bang branch. Whereas other people have thought, like Sakharov, thought that, in fact, the closed model that we have, which is K equal to one universe, in which there are many, many cycles, that is how the final theory should look like, etc. So these questions are not really new questions, but we are looking at them from the viewpoint of quantum gravity. Now, there are some other questions, which are also long-standing questions. And the first one that I want to emphasize, and maybe the only one that I want to emphasize, is really that this, to me, was a technically hard problem. There is really a tension between ultraviolet and infrared issues. See, if you use perturbative approaches, then by construction, you get a good infrared behavior because zero order, you assume you have got general relativity plus matter, and then you are actually adding on quantum corrections. But then it's not clear what happens near the Big Bang. Is the Big Bang singularity resolved? Because the perturbative methods would not work near the Big Bang. If you use, on the other hand, non-perturbative approaches, then there is a hope that, in fact, near the Big Bang, new quantum effects might be unleashed, and they may cure the Big Bang singularity. But now, once these are unleashed, these quantum gravity effects, new effects that you have, will also have a long time to grow and accumulate. And therefore, it may be that the universe has evolved 40 billion years. And so maybe now, even today, there will be some discrepancy between what we see and what general relativity predicts. And we don't seem to see any such discrepancy. Therefore, the burden on a non-perturbative approach is to unleash quantum gravity effects to cure the singularity and switch them off very quickly so that even after 14 billion years, there is not much remnant now. Today, this fundamental non-perturbative theory should agree with general relativity with remarkable accuracy. So the perturbative approaches have no trouble with the infrared problem, but they have trouble with the ultraviolet problem. Non-perturbative approaches may cure the ultraviolet problem, but then they have this big burden to really make sure that, in fact, these quantum gravity effects are all compatible with the fact that general relativity is an excellent approximation today. And this is an issue that has been emphasized particularly by Green and Unruh. Now, in loop quantum gravity cosmology, these issues have been resolved, the ones that I have in the previous transparency, these issues, as well as this issue up here. And physical observables, they have been resolved for several homogeneous cosmological models. And physical observables, which are classically singular, for example, matter density, have that singular, the Big Bang. They turn out that in loop quantum cosmology, they have dynamically induced upper bounds in the physical universe space. So things that were classically singular, in principle, could not be singular because in the entire Hilbert space, the spectrum of the density operator has an upper bound, so you could never get any state with infinite density. But this framework is mathematically, by now, it's been put in a mathematically rigorous footing, and also is conceptually complete, again, conceptually in the sense of this mathematical physics is conceptually complete. The emerging scenario is that in the simplest model, there in fact are vast classical regions that are bridged deterministically by quantum geometry. So there is no quantum form, there is in fact other classical universes. And there is no new principle needed, such as the Hawking-Hartle boundary condition, to join the pre-Big Bang and the post-Big Bang branches. So here is Arndt's conception. In the first picture, in general relativity, we just have the future bound in the k equal to zero model. In general, space is just expanding up here. Whereas here, what is happening is that there is also a pre-Big Bang branch, which is contracting, post-Big Bang, our branch, which is expanding, and they are joined together here by a quantum bridge. And this is the picture that I would like to present to you in some mathematical detail in this colloquium today. So let me go now begin with this is the end of the introduction. And let me begin with the simplest models. And the simplest model I would like to consider is a k equal to zero, so spatially flat, a Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker model. And this model is going to be coupled to massless scalar field phi. I can add other scalar fields, other matter fields, not radiation dust, it's trying to form a picture. But the important thing for now is that there should be at least one massless scalar field. This is important in order for me to give a simple level colloquium talk. If in fact you have no massless scalar field, if there is only inflationary potential or something else, the framework still goes through, but then to explain it to you will take me twice as long. And so I'm going to assume that I got at least one massless scalar field. So in this case, if I have a massless scalar field and a Friedman-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker model, I can plot the volume of the universe against a scalar field. And we find that in classical general relativity, there are two kinds of solutions. One is, there's one which starts with the Big Bang, where the volume is zero, which starts up here, and then the field is actually minus infinity, and it expands out and grows, and the volume just increases and goes to infinity. And the other classes of solutions are just the time reverses, namely, the universe starts out with infinite volume, and then contracts, and then goes and it contracts out to zero, the zero volume, so to the big crunch in gravity. So the question that we want to ask is the following. Supposing in quantum gravity, you have a quantum theory of gravity, and you take a wave function which is sharply peaked at a point like this in this diagram. So at some volume, it has some value of the scalar field up here. And then the idea is that you evolve this wave function back in time. What happens? Does it follow the classical trajectory if you evolve it forward and backward in time? If it does follow the classical trajectory, when the universe is large, then you have solved the infrared problem. You have agreement with general relativity. But if the sharply peaked wave function as you evolve back in time, what happens to it? Does it go into the singularity or does something else happen to it? So this is the question that we want to ask. Now, many of you here are experts on gravity, and you know the issue of time and so on. And really, you don't really need a time variable sitting out there, a global clock, in order to talk about quantum gravity effects. You can do it without it. You can talk about relational observables. But again, in a simple talk, it is useful to have a notion of time, because then we can make contact with the physics that we're all very quickly, easily familiar. Now, of course, there's no clock ticking there in the early universe going tick, tick, tick. So what we need to do is to choose one of the variables as being an internal clock with respect to which others evolve. And as we see here, the way that I plot it, scalar field phi can serve as an internal clock. It is monotonic along all these dynamical trajectories. In this case, the volume is also monotonic. But in the closed universe, it's k equal to 1 universe. Volume is not monotonic. The universe expands onto a large volume and then recollapses again. But the scalar field is still monotonic in that case. So scalar field is a convenient clock variable. And very often when I talk about evolve, etc., I would mean evolution with respect to the internal time or relational time that is defined by the scalar field. So what happens in the older cosmology? So these are the theories that were looked at in great detail by first by Savage, John Misner, John Weaver, and so on. And the basic idea is that since we are reduced the degrees of freedom by homogeneity and isotropy assumptions, the scale factor, the metric is all contained in the scale factor, which moreover is just a function of time. And we have a scalar field, which is only a function of time. So there are only finitely many degrees of freedom. There's 2 degrees of freedom up here. And therefore, the field theoretical difficulties are bypassed, and the analysis is reduced to standard quantum mechanics. And the question now is, do we have what happens in the ordinary hydrogen atom? Is it true that the uncertainty principle somehow resolves the Big Bang singularity? So the bottom states are functions, wave functions of the scalar factor and the scalar field. The scalar factor, for example, would operate by multiplication, the scalar field also, conjugate momenta by differentiation, etc. And then the quantum evolution is governed by the quantum Einstein equation, which is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. In this context, there is only one constraint of Einstein equation, which is non-trivial, the Hamiltonian constraint, and it tells you that, in fact, the wave function cannot be an arbitrary function of A and phi, but you satisfy this differential equation. It says that the second derivative with respect to the scale factor is equal to some constant times that Hamiltonian of phi operating on the wave function. The function of f of A here depends on the particular factor ordering that one might have used. But it turns out that this freedom in choosing the factor ordering is not sufficient. And if I were just to use the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, then in a precise sense, really, without additional assumptions, singularity is not resolved. And therefore, the general belief since the 70s is that there's an impasse, because in Wheeler-DeWitt theory, in this simple model, the singularity is not resolved. So in this simple model, as we'll see, I think, in a minute, what happens is that the wave function, which is sharply peaked on this trajectory, remains sharply peaked and just evolves back into the singularity. The density grows unboundedly, and therefore, in this sense, the singularity is not resolved. Now, the general belief was that, well, this is not a problem of just the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but in fact, it's a true impasse. And why? It is because of the von Neumann uniqueness theorem of quantum mechanics. So unless you bring in some extra input, such as the Hawking boundary condition or something, singularity would not go away. And what does the von Neumann's uniqueness theorem tell us? It basically says that there's only one way of doing ordinary quantum mechanics. And I will say a little bit more about that in the next class. And it's a standard way, and that is what the Wheeler-DeWitt equation did. And the singularity in this simple model is not resolved. And therefore, it really doesn't matter. I mean, this really basic fundamental problem doesn't matter if you try to reformulate a problem in some other way. But it turns out that in loop quantum cosmology, the situation is very different. And this is because of the use of quantum Riemannian geometry. Of course, immediately the question arises, but how can this be possible? What about the von Neumann theorem? Well, in the Wheeler-DeWitt quantum cosmology, one did not have guidance from a full quantum guidance theory. Therefore, when it came to quantum cosmology, one just followed the standard quantum mechanics and constructed the Schrödinger representation of the fundamental Heisenberg algebra or the exponential inverse graphic of the Y algebra. But by contrast, in loop quantum gravity, the quantum kinematics has been rigorously developed. We have a uniqueness here that says that if you want to do the gravity theory in terms of these gravitational connections, then there is exactly one representation that you can use because of background independence or because of diffeomorphism invariance. And this unique representation is that of the kinematic algebra, that like algebra of X's and P. And this theorem was proved by Lewandowski, Okada, Salman, Chiman, and independently by Fleischer, just a in about a couple of years ago. And this provides an arena to formulate quantum Einstein's equations, and that is what loop quantum gravity does. Our problem is much simpler. We just have quantum cosmology. So what we will do is we follow the procedure followed in loop quantum gravity. Here we have a guidance now. We follow that procedure, and we apply it to quantum cosmology. The system in which all but few finitely many degrees of freedom are frozen because of symmetry requirements. In this quantum mechanical system, if we apply this particular procedure, then one of the assumptions of the von Neumann theorem is violated, and therefore von Neumann's uniqueness theorem is bypassed. We have got new representations of the wild commutation relations, so we have new quantum mechanics. This quantum mechanics is not useful in ordinary, to describe atoms and molecules, etc. It's not directly useful for that, because there, assumptions of von Neumann's theorems are respected, and we have ordinary Schrodinger mechanics there. Mathematically, this exists, but it's not directly useful. In loop quantum gravity, the situation is just opposite. Namely, the ordinary Fock-like representation exists, but the diffeomorphism of invariance tells us that that's not the right thing to use. We gain our uniqueness theorem, and if we use it, we are led to new quantum mechanics. So again, those students who follow mathematical physics, let me just tell you very quickly what the von Neumann's uniqueness theorem says and what is happening. It says the following, that you can start with one parameter family of unitary operators, U of lambda and V of lambda, mu. And you think of them as being exponentially an X operator and a P operator. But this is not given to you in the beginning. We're just given that there are these one parameter family of unitary operators. Supposing they act on a Hilbert space and they satisfy the commutation relations. These are the wild commutation relations, which just come from the Heisenberg commutation relations, if this was satisfied. And if in fact we have weak continuity in these parameters mu and lambda, what does it mean? It means that the matrix element in any state are continuous with respect to the parameter lambda and mu. Then there's a unique irreducible up to isomorphism, there's a unique irreducible representation of this algebra. And this is the standard Schrodinger representation in which U of lambda is of this type, V of mu is of this type. In loop quantum gravity, X is like a connection, gravitational connection, and P is its conjugate momentum, is like a spatial triad. And what happens is that it is only this, if you, in this representation, what happens is that the exponentials of the connections, which are like the holonomies, they are well defined, but the connection itself is not well defined. Therefore, the assumption that U of lambda is legally continuous in lambda fails, and therefore the von Neumann theorem is bypassed, and we've got new quantum mechanics. And as one might suspect, novel features arise precisely in the deep black regime. So what happens here? We again take the same picture. I mean, this is the picture in which we are classically, it's very faint, but maybe you can see that these green lines which start up here, this is the branch which starts the Big Bang, expands out to infinity. This is a branch which starts out at infinity and contracts into big crunch singularity. So we start again with a wave function up here, which is sharply peaked. And this is the expectation value, the volume, at a given instant of time, which is 5. And there are some fluctuations. And then you actually evolve this back in time and see what happens. The good news is that the wave function remains peaked sharply on the classical trajectory. In the future, there is no problem at all. And even in the past, it remains sharply, there is no problem. Until this event, when the matter density is about 1% of Planck density. At this event, quantum geometry corrections become very important, and the classical trajectory would have gone into the Big Bang singularity. Instead, the quantum trajectory turns around and goes on to infinity. So there's a quantum bounce. So this is a new effect of quantum geometry, which is a key point which we would like to talk about in this talk a little bit more. So this is a picture of what happens in the wave function. This is the absolute value of the wave function. You give yourself a wave function. This is a phi, this is time, this is a volume. So you give yourself a wave function which is sharply peaked at some time up here, at some volume. And now you evolve it backward in time. It follows the classical trajectory, then sharply peaked, goes up to here, but instead of going to the singularity, it bounces and comes back out here. So to summarize, we assume that the quantum state is semi-classical at late time and evolve backward in time, and also forward in time. Then, the state remains semi-classical until very early and very late times, that is to say, until the scalar curvature, which is the only non-trivial invariant, curvature invariant in the homogeneous isotropic case, is about 1 upon Planck length squared, or the matter density is about 1% of the Planck density. So until here, general relativity is an excellent approximation. Now, at the onset of inflation, the density is about 10 to the minus 12 rho Planck. So it tells us now that, in fact, it is quite safe to assume that general relativity is correct at the onset of inflation, because already when it is 1% of Planck density, general relativity starts becoming extremely accurate. In the deep Planck regime, semi-classicality fades. But the quantum evolution equation is well defined through the Planck regime and remains deterministic, unlike in other approaches. This is a non-perturbative approach. We only have a quantum evolution equation, and that quantum evolution equation doesn't break down. The quantum Hamiltonian operator is self-adjoint, there's no problem. And therefore, we do not need a new principle, such as the Hawking-Hartle or Wellington boundary condition. The situation is the same if we include a cosmological constant or an inflationary potential. And in all cases, the quantum space time is vastly larger than what general relativity had led us to believe. I would emphasize that the singularity resolution did not come because we used some matter which violated some energy condition. There is no unphysical matter. All the energy conditions are satisfied. So then one would say, what happened to the singularity theorems then? Right? I mean, just we have got the Penrose Hawking theorems. We say that under all the general conditions, you should have singularity. But what happens, of course, is that Einstein equation is changed. We don't have Einstein's equation anymore. Because of quantum geometry, the left-hand side of Einstein's equation is modified. And this is really directly because the area operator, or the area operator in general geometric operators, have discrete eigenvalues. And this is the main difference from the Wiedereweber theory, that in fact, you have got a fundamental discreteness in geometry. So, the fundamental equation that you would get from loop quantum gravity, if you looked at the expectation values and tried to obtain a classical equation, or obtain a differential equation, or obtain an equation which looks like a familiar equation, then what it changed is the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. But in order to compare with what we're familiar with normally, it is easier to do an algebraic manipulation, just as some simplification, and move the quantum correction to the right-hand side. And the interesting thing is that one can do this. When you do that, you throw the Friedmann equation, you get a modified Friedmann equation. So here, the left-hand side is still the Hubble parameter square, a dot by a whole square, is equal to, the classical equation would have been a dot by a whole square, equal to 8 pi g rho by 3. But instead, you get now a quantum correction. This quantum correction is 1 minus rho upon rho critical, where rho critical is about 0.41 rho Planck. And this is a value that is obtained in cosmological constant, in k equal to universes, k equal to 0 universes, etc. So it seems like a constant for this family of simple cosmological models. I mean, the universal value, the value is universal for this family of cosmological models. Now, so you say, okay, this happened, you've got a big deal, you've got a different sign here, I mean, you've got a correction here, so what does it have to do with the fact that there's a quantum bounce? Well, classically what happened? Classically, we had two branches. We had the expanding branch and the contracting branch. In the expanding branch, A dot is always positive. In the contracting branch, A dot is always negative. In the classical Friedmann equation, A dot by A is equal to 8 pi g rho by 3. Rho is positive here. Therefore, this quantity it never vanishes. So if A dot is positive somewhere, it's always positive. So if the universe were expanding, it's always expanding. If it's contracting, it's always contracting. But now I got this extra term which can vanish somewhere, namely at rho equal to rho critical. So this term vanishes at rho equal to rho critical, therefore A dot vanishes there. Therefore, the expanding universe can turn into contracting, or contracting universe can turn into expanding. The fact that the Friedemann equation is modified in this particular way with a factor which I put a negative sign here is critical for the quantum bounds to occur. Now, in the brain world scenarios, for example, we have got a similar equation, but there's a plus sign up here in the Randall syndrome one. If you have the physical tension for the brain, then it will be a plus sign, and therefore the feedback is not avoided. It's not somewhat remarkable that in quantum loop quantum gravity, you did not put anything by hand, you just follow, use quantum Einstein's equation, saw what happens, and it comes naturally with a negative sign. Now, one can prove something much more general in the scale equal to zero model. You can construct a density operator, which is really volume, density at a given instant of time phi, is given by the volume at the instant of time phi to the power of minus one, actually it's minus two, I just made it into a separate joint operator. And here you have got the 1/2 times t hat squared phi is the energy. T hat squared is really the momentum, which is canonically conjugate to the scalar field. So this is just the matter density. T hat squared times v to the minus 2 is the matter density of the scalar field. And I just use the factor ordering to make it separate job. So what one can show is that in loop quantum cosmology, this operator has an absolute upper bound on the physical universe space. So it's not only just states, just semi-classical, which are this property. On the entire universe space, no matter what state you choose, it is true that there is actually an upper bound to the density. So density could, in principle, never get infinity. And the maximum upper bound, the sup of this bound, is given by an analytical formula where gamma is, most of you know, is this Barbieri-Mirzi parameter. And we take the value for the Barbieri-Mirzi parameter, which comes from black hole entropy calculations, you plug it in, and you get this to be equal to 0.41 rho plot. And this is exactly the value that was observed in all these numerical evolutions that were done. We can ask, when does this bounce occur? What is the density at this bounce point? It is exactly, within numerical errors, it is exactly equal to 0.41. And now we understand analytically why, because in fact, that is upper bound, and one is getting close to this upper bound at the bounce point. So what is happening is that quantum geometry creates a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, and it replaces the Big Bang by quantum bounds. And therefore, physics does not stop at the singularities. Well, new repulsive forces of quantum mechanical origin are something that we are familiar with. That's what happens when a star collapses. When a star collapses, there are fermions, either the electrons or the neutrons, let me talk about neutrons. You cannot put two neutrons in the same state, you've got probably exclusion principle. Because of that, there's a Fermi degeneracy pressure, and therefore the star actually is balanced because there is a repulsive force coming from the Fermi degeneracy force and the attractive force, which is coming from gravity. The two are balanced with each other, and therefore we have got stable equilibrium particles. If you had used classical physics, you don't have this force, the star should just collapse. So new equilibrium configurations arise because of quantum mechanical repulsive forces of which classical theories have no inkling. However, if the star were more than 5 solar masses, then the degeneracy force we know is not repulsive force, is not strong enough to counter the gravitational attraction. Star collapses and forms a black hole, according to general relativity. The new repulsive force here is not, it has its origin not in quantum matter, but in quantum geometry. Therefore, it's not universally applicable, and it really doesn't matter how big the collapsing mass is. No matter how big the collapsing mass is, the repulsive force is strong enough to halt the gravitational collapse and cause a bounce. And this is, again, because this is force. The fact that it is of quantum origin is perhaps not so surprising. This we have seen before. But a new element with that is that its origin is in quantum geometry and not quantum matter. Okay, let me just that was one topic about covariant entropy bound. Just for the expert, I'll just say it in two lines what it was, and then go to the k equal to 1 model. Basically, based on black hole entropy calculations, people have proposed that there should be an absolute entropy bound. And the most developed, and the most believed, the proposal with the most chance of being true is that of Raphael Busso. But if you take Raphael Busso's proposal and apply it to the Friedman model, classical Friedman model, if you are very close to the Big Bang singularity, the entropy bound of Raphael's is actually voided, or Busso is actually voided. So a natural question is what happens in loop quantum cosmology? Well, in loop quantum cosmology, the singularity is dissolved, and there is enough structure to actually formulate Raphael's bound to calculate it, and in loop quantum cosmology, the Busso bound is actually preserved. Thus, the resolution of the singularity is at the same time restoring the Busso bound, which was voided in the past. If there are questions, I can go into more details. Okay, let me tell you a few things about the closed portal. And this, by the mentor, called them the Phoenix universe. Okay, so what happens in this closed model? So classically, again, the universe here, I'm taking it to begin the Big Bang, it expands out to maximal volume, and then it recollapses. So these are the models in which k equal to 1. So the topology is that of a three-sphere, it's a closed model. It will expand out to a more large volume and then collapses again. There's a spatial curvature. It's not space is not flat because it's three-sphere. And this curvature term is the one which balances the gravitational attraction, and that causes this bounce up here. So where does this bound? So classically, the universe expands with a Big Bang, undergoes a classical recollapse and goes into a Big Crunch singularity. So again, we ask the same question. We take a wave function which is sharply peaked at some point up here. We evolve it forward in time and we evolve it backward in time. And we want to know what happens. The ultraviolet question is it true that the Big Bang singularity and the Big Crunch singularities are resolved? Are there quantum balances? The infrared issue is there a classical recollapse? General relativity says there's a classical recollapse at a certain, if you tell me the classical solution, if you tell me what the value of the scalar field momentum P phi is, I will tell you what the maximum radius of the universe is. Is it the case that in your quantum theory there's a recollapse? And is it the case that it happens at the value that general relativity predicted if the universe is macroscopic? So there's an ultraviolet problem, and then the infrared problem that we would like to address. So in the derivative theory, you again take a wave function, you evolve it forward in time and backward in time. It passes the infrared problem test with flying colors. You do have a recollapse up here, and it goes back. However, unfortunately, it follows a classical trajectory into the Big Bang singularity and the Big Crunch singularity. So there is no problem in the infrared, but there is a problem in the ultraviolet. Singularity is not resolved. In loop quantum gravity, we ask the same question. In loop quantum cosmology, we evolve the wave function forward in time. Again, the wave function recollapses, as classical general relativity told us. Over here, the universe is very large, and therefore we should not have quantum gravity effect should not be important. As you evolve backward in time, instead of actually going into the Big Bang singularity, with the quantum bounce, the universe goes back. Instead of evolving into the Big Crunch singularity, there's a quantum bounce, the universe goes back. Goes out again. And thus we have got this cyclic behavior. It's not exactly periodic, but it is cyclic behavior of the quantum bounces followed by classical recollapses. But there are two points that I want to emphasize here. What we would like to understand is what is the domain of validity for classical general relativity. As I emphasized just a minute ago, the classical recollapse is an infrared issue. Because this happens, the classical recollapse happens up here, where the universe is large, the matter density is low, the general relativity should be valid. What? And of course, when the universe is largest, the matter density is the smallest. So you ought to know what is the minimum value of rho matter density in quantum gravity? Classically, it is just given by 3 by 8 pi times g times a max, the maximum value of scale factor squared, which is a classical formula. It gets corrected, but the correction is of the order of Planck length to the 4th about a max to the 4th. So for a macroscopic universe which grows through light years in maximum value, volume, this is Planck length divided by light years to the 4th power, and therefore this term is totally, completely, incredibly negligible. And you get classical relativity. There is no infrared problem. So one might say, well, let's push on that and see what happens. Supposing I give my initial conditions such that classically the universe just expands out only to 25 Planck length and recollapses. It's a very, very tiny universe. These solutions exist in general relativity, there's no problem. Universe starts with Big Bang, expands to 25 Planck length, recollapses into become singularity. Now we take this solution and apply quantum gravity and see, is classical general relativity a good approximation even for such a solution? So this is pushing your luck as much as we can. And the amazing answer is yes. The amazing answer is that if your A max is about 23 Planck length, this corresponds to value of P phi. Value of P phi determines the value of A max. P phi is a constant of motion. Then there is agreement that the classical Friedman formula to 1% to 1 part e to the 5 with this classical formula, this term is only 1 part e to the 5. And classical general relativity is an excellent approximation between about 8 Planck length and 23 Planck length. It's only between 8, 0, or only between the recollapse time and the 8 Planck length that is not a good classical general relativity has to be corrected. Quantum corrections are important, but those quantum corrections are so important that they actually halt the gravitational collapse. For macroscopic universes, which grow to light years, these quantum corrections are totally negligible. So this to me was a pleasant surprise. If somebody had asked me before that if I had a universe which just grew to 25 Planck length, is classical general relativity valid anywhere? I would have probably said no. I said it can't be valid. But that Einstein's equations capture quantum physics very well between 8 Planck and 23 Planck is really, really interesting. So the interesting thing is that in this universe, or in fact in any case, quantum effects rise very quickly when you are very close to the singularity, and then they die off very quickly. Now this is something that I personally had not expected to come out of anything. I thought this would be some incredible artificial input that you would have to give to the theory for this to happen. That the repulsive force is so strong as to halt the gravitational attraction, and yet so short-lived that it makes no difference that general relativity is perfectly valid very soon after this quantum bounce that occurs. Second thing is the ultra-volume issue. So one can ask, when are the quantum connections important? So now I would like to take the opposite kind of universe. I would actually take the universe which grows to large macroscopic sizes. So for example, let us take a universe for which the maximum radius is about a megaparsec. It's not a very large universe, but you can take that to be 1 megaparsec up here. And then one can ask, when does this universe bounce? What is the minimum volume that we can have? At the bounce, quantum gravity effects are most important. They completely dominate physics. Because without them, there will be collapse to the singularity. So what happens at the bounce? So you have a universe which classically starts with Big Bang, expands out to 1 megaparsec, collapses. But mechanically, we start with this 1 megaparsec, evolve backward in time, and come very, very close to the Planck density, maybe 0.41 times Planck density, and we want to ask, what is the minimum volume of the universe? The minimum volume of the universe is about 10 to the 16 centimeter cube. That is to say, it's about 10 to the 115 Planck length cube. So this is enormous, this is the size of a mountain. This is huge, 10 to 16 centimeter cube. And even then, quantum gravity effects are important. Now very often, as I have seen before, statements that, well, all these are important only when the universe grows universal the size of Planck, Planck size. That's not true. What matters is really the curvature, not the volume. At what time, at what scale is the curvature entering the Planck regime? If it enters the Planck regime, then the universe is very large. Well, I mean, all the driving effects are going to be more. And if I take this universe and I ask in classical general relativity what happens at this volume, when this universe reaches this volume, you will find that the curvature is reaching Planck scale, and therefore quantum gravity effects are important. So there are some small lessons here to be learned, which are, I think, conceptually interesting. Okay, let me begin my summary now. Before summarizing, let me just mention one point, which has to do with merits and limitations of quantum cosmology. And this is a question that has been around for more than 30 years, ever since, you know, Wheeler, David, Mizuno started playing with mini superspaces. In mini superspaces, one is actually freezing all but a finite number of degrees of freedom. So it looks like an oversimplification. It looks like an incredible simplification. And so one is rightly worried about, well, okay, one gets all these results, but can we really trust them? I mean, it's a full quantum gravity theory going to really say that at least qualitatively we agree with these results, but it's something completely different going to happen. Of course, today we don't know the answer. Right away, I should say to you that we do not know how to treat these systems without symmetry reduction first. We do not know how to treat them in the full context of loop quantum gravity. And therefore, the question is important. But I would like to give you three arguments to say that these toy models. Actually, these are examples, they can be part. The first argument is the following. Let me take the hypothetical case that we have full quantum electrodynamics. Somehow, you know, somebody came and told us how to calculate all the scattering amplitude, the radiative corrections, Feynman diagrams, everything. But somehow nobody had found how to do hydrogen atom. So supposing this happened, you know, we do all the S matrices, etc. The bound state problem is so hard in full quantum electrodynamics, I don't know how to do it. Then Dirac comes along and Dirac says, well, wait a minute. Why don't we do the following simplification? Just consider spherical symmetry. Of course, somebody else says, well, but if you do that, you kill all photons because they are radiative degrees of freedom. And Dirac says, yeah, yeah, just consider spherical symmetry. And just consider, think of the electron as being one particle, nucleus as being one particle, and just solve this Dirac equation. Look, this equation is very simple. I just solve it. I get the system. I get these energy levels. Of course, one's first reaction is, wait a minute, you've thrown away infinitely many degrees of freedom, why should I trust your answer? And the answer is, the statement is partly that we know. The answer is damn good. Of course, my corrections to it. Lamb shift is a G correction coming from quantum electrodynamics. The qualitative picture is really the same that Dirac told us. So, examples can be part. Secondly, look at the singularity theorems of classical general relativity. In classical general relativity, singularities were first discovered for systems which have high degree of symmetry, Schwarzschild, Friedman, Robertson, Walker, etc. And there was a widespread belief that this is an artifact of high symmetry. And there was a whole Russian school program led by Lipschitz and Kolotnikov to show that general solution to Einstein's equation would be non-singular. If you had no symmetries, then generically it would be non-singular. But then came the shocking theorems of Penrose and Hawking, and they told us that, in fact, singularities are commonplace, in fact. And that changed the picture completely. Now what is happening is that we have looked at some very simple models, and in these simple models, we find that singularities are resolved. By no means this implies that they will be always resolved in general relativity, but we should not dismiss this possibility a priori by saying that, well, it's just too trivial, this could never be true. We should just pursue, and maybe it's not, they are not resolved, but the question is, we should really try to find out. And the final thing is about approach to space-like singularities. The singularities of general relativity that one would like to resolve in quantum gravity most are the space-like singularities. Now, as you approach space-like singularities, there's a conjecture due to Belinsky, Kolotnikov, and Lipschitz. This was a follow-up or corrected work after the earlier work of Kolotnikov and Lipschitz. And this conjecture says that as we approach a space-like singularity at the Big Bang, here is a Big Bang, time is running like that, and as I approach the Big Bang singularity, in fact, the spatial derivatives become subdominant, and the time derivatives dominate the physics completely. so that what is happening at one point becomes essentially decoupled from what is happening at a nearby point. So this is the BKL conjecture. And therefore, what it furthermore, it says that in fact, what is happening at one point is very well described by so-called Bianchi-1 models. Now, Bianchi-1 models are homogeneous models, and as I'll explain in a minute, in this case, loop quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology has been carried out, and we know that the singularity is resolved. So, the BKL conjecture tells us the behavior of the gravitational field as we approach singularity. It is dominated by the Bianchi-1 model, and in the Bianchi-1 model, the singularity is resolved. So, there is some, again, surprising or tantalizing hope that in fact, singularity is generically resolved. These arguments are not conclusive. They do not imply that the behavior found in examples is necessarily generic, but rather they reveal important aspects of full theory, and they should not be dismissed properly. There are also lessons for full quantum gravity coming from cosmology. What is happening now, people are working their way up to more and more complicated models. I just mentioned to you about the Bianchi-1 model. The Bianchi-2 model is also being worked on. And there are also models which are called Gaudi models, which are infinitely many degrees of freedom. And these also have been looked at. And so what is working one's way up to more and more complicated models. And at each step, these models provide important physical checks beyond formal mathematics. And they have strong lessons for the full theory. And that is what is being used today. Okay. Summary then is that in loop quantum gravity, the interplay between geometry and physics is elevated to quantum mechanical level. We are quantum Riemannian geometry. Singularities and homogeneous classical general relativity are resolved. Quantum spacetimes can be vastly larger than what general relativity has us believe. And that, therefore, we have this fact as ramifications for some of the most interesting issues in cosmology and physics. For k equal to 1, k equal to 1, 0 and 1, Friedman, Robertson, Walker universes, with or without a cosmology constant, there's a complete control on the physical sector of the theory. Loop quantum cosmology evolution is deterministic across the classical Big Bang and Big Crunch for all quantum states, not just for the quantum states, which are semi-classical at late times, but for all quantum states. And singularities are resolved because of unforeseen quantum geometry effects at the Planck scale. And there's some recent work that Param Singh here has done. He gave a talk on this, in his International Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar. And that shows that in the effective field, all singularities of homogeneous isotropic models are resolved. Not just the Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities, but also the other kinds of singularities that might occur, such as the Big Rip singularity, there's a classification of four kinds. And this work shows that all the singularities would be resolved. This work is, however, not at the level of full quantum theory, but just using the effective equations, which have been very successful in the models that have been looked at in great detail. More general models have also been studied, and they indicate that singularity resolution is robust. And I already mentioned to you about the Bianchi-1 model. And what happens is that there's not a simple bounce point, but rather, every time a curvature invariant enters a Planck regime, there is quantum gravity intervenes and gives dominant corrections, and therefore dynamics is modified. So basically, any time the curvature invariant is increasing, classical general relativity keep increasing, quantum cosmology it increases until it reaches some Planck scale value, and then it dilutes again because of this repulsive force. There's not a single bounce. There's not a single bounce, but the situation is much more complicated. And the challenge to the background independent theories, namely detailed recovery of general relativity at low curvature densities, is met. Not only is the singularity resolved, but there is agreement with general relativity at low curvatures without any problem. So the problems that I began with, the questions that I began with, the list of questions for any quantum gravity theory, many of them, most of them, have been addressed in some remarkable detail in the quantum cosmology today. So here is, for example, what happens in, if you have a negative cosmology constant, it behaves a little bit like what happens in the k equal to zero model. Here we have got a classical recollapse because the cosmological constant term in the energy density is balanced by this, the magic term. And here you would have a Big Crunch singularity. Instead of that, there's a quantum bounce. So there are these quantum bounces, in interspace with classical informatics. Okay. Now, this has been the long question that I began with, mainly, what was there before the Big Bang? And broadly, people talked about these Phoenix universes, a term which was introduced by Lemaître, and then studied by De Sitter, Tolman, Gamow, Dickey, Sakharov, Weinberg, etc. And there many people had expressed hopes and philosophical preferences that quite often, particularly in the first part of the 20th century, the views about what happens before the Big Bang were strongly influenced by one's general political views. A very interesting corollary there. People who were more conservative wanted to have a Big Bang, and people who were more liberal wanted to have a cycling universe. No absolute beginning, and so on. Luckily, since the 50s, that disappeared. But still, Gamow in particular wanted to have what we saw in the K=0 universe. Just one big Big Bang branch, where Dickey, for example, favored the oscillating universe, the Phoenix universe, which goes on. So Weinberg has said that, well, it would be nice if the universe were doing that, because it would get us out of the problem of genesis, and so on. But these are ideas that people are sort of speculate on because of their philosophical or emotional preferences. But the important thing here is that these are not, what happens is now being predicted by equations. The singularity is resolved in loop quantum gravity, and the loop quantum cosmology equations provided with deterministic evolution for the pre-Big Bang to the post-Big Bang part. And what happens before the quantum bounce is not a philosophical preference, but depends on the cosmological parameters today. If in fact, today at late times, the universe is looks like K=0, the density is very close to the critical density, or it is equal to the critical density, then there is only one Big Bang branch. If in fact the universe looks like it's capable of one, which it seems not to look like, if it were to look like that, then in fact it would have this oscillating universes. So the question, in the best tradition of physics, the philosophical preferences have been reduced to observational issues. And the nice thing is that these observation issues are not about early universe, but what is happening now. We tell you what is happening now, I evolve back and tell you what happened before the Big Bang. Finally, just over the last year and a half, cosmologists are now working with the loop quantum cosmology experts to explore phenomenological implications. There are several of them, and in particular that might be of interest here is really the ramification of quantum geometry effects on the ekpyrotic and cyclic models, how some of these quote-unquote incompletenesses about what happens when the brains actually collide, and it's sort of the Big Bang, and how they separate out, etc., have been resolved very neatly now by Param Singh and his collaborators. Thank you.
This is a very beautiful talk. We have questions, comments. Celine.
If you say the curvature comes into the Planckian regime and you change the scalar, so what do you do if the scalar is just zero?
Then there's a four-dimensional curvature scale. So four-dimensional curvature scale is just zero.
Yeah. So it's a trace of the energy momentum change the light. It could just vanish.
So in these models, I'm only talking about the models that I talked about were homogeneous isotropic models. In that case, if in fact scalar curvature is zero, then space-time is flat. Because there's no wild tensor, and isotropy tells us that you can expect the whole tensor, or whole curvature scalar, sorry, whole rigid tensor in terms of scalar curvature. If you have anisotropic models, then you also have wild curvature, there are more curvature in that case. Then it is no longer the case that only the curvature, scalar curvature matters. As I was saying here, every time a curvature invariant reaches the Planck scale, and this curvature invariance, you want wild curvature, the potentials of wild curvature shifts. So anytime that enters the Planck scale, there is a departure from classical general relativity, quantum gravity, etc.
Okay, Justin?
Yeah, so in all the examples you showed, if I trace back the history in time, you have a balance. Now, well, I know Lee has a model, but that's why I'm asking. So for example, if you consider more intricate models where you have, let's say, a potential for the scalar field, do you ever get a situation where tracing back in time you find a static universe extends?
I think Parab can answer this question.
I think it will require a lot of fine-tuning of the potential, but it's a possible solution.
So this has been looked at. I mean, this is, it is realized, but you might say more of a fine-tuning that is involved in order for you to get a static solution. Yes.
So just very briefly, so one thought that occurred to me is that let's suppose in the most pessimistic case that somehow these bounces would rely on linear space approximation in more complicated situations. Then maybe one could turn this around and use that to explain why universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Like maybe these other patches disappear. And
there also is very interesting ideas that, for example, that Paul Steinhardt and David Garfinkel and Franz Pretorius and Lim have proposed recently about there is actually maybe a mechanism for this homogenizing and isotropizing as you approach the Big Bang and with certain potentials which actually occur in ekpyrotic models. And so what you say is right, but there's also this other possibility, namely that there might be a real mechanism that even though today, of course, it's very far from being, there are local scales of structures, but actually as you go to the singularity, it might homogenize and isotropize. So.
Okay, are there any questions not from that corner of the room? Okay, Rob?
There's something intuitively I'm trying to understand here. You give this, there's kind of quantum pressure that's preventing this from happening, but it's not really like the Pauli exclusion principle. We have fermions, so it's not a Fermi pressure. Exactly. So what's puzzling is you've got bosons exerting, it's more like a particle in a box. Is that right?
So what is happening in the following? You have, first of all, I agree completely, there are no fermions, bosons. So what we have got is really gravitational flux lines, which is not something that one sees normally in properties. There are these flux lines. And what is happening is that these flux lines, they large microscopically, they give you the gravitational propagator and you have good bosonic behavior, etc. But still, there are flux lines of a connection. Okay, there are the horons of a connection. So it's really like what happens in, okay, in gauge theory. And then what happens is that because geometry is quantized, don't put too many flux lines. If you try to put too many flux lines in some little area, this is a heuristic idea, then it's just not possible. So the fact that it's not possible, you can intuitively think of this being that they repel. For example, I got some area here, and I got a flux line, which is gives me the minimum quantum mechanical area. Then I just can't put another flux line. It's a little like what happens in type 2 superconducting.
Sort of a flux line pressure.
It's a flux line pressure. It's a little like, mathematically, there's a close analogy in type 2 superconductor in which it's repulsed. The magnetic flux lines are actually repulsed out. And that is kind of the behavior that is happening.
Okay.
I have no question. We know in classical general relativity, it's the Richard Wray equation that play a critical role in the proof of singularity in theory. My question is, do you think if it's more convenient for us to provide a generic proof of singularity resolution conjecture in quantum regime by using quantized Richard Wray equation rather than Einstein equation?
Yeah, so I think that's probably right. So that's what one can do. One can look at the effective, there's a Lagrangian effective Friedmann equation. There's also effective Reichelder equation. And one can look at that equation and try to use that to show at least in effective theories, there is no singularity. And that is largely successful. This is largely a good idea. Now, whether one can go beyond that, I do not know. Because even in the full quantum theory here, I wrote down the Friedmann equation. That's also to give us an understanding of what is happening. And that was just an effective equation. But the important thing is that the effective equation is extremely good. I mean, if you look at what in any of these models, say for example, this model here, if I looked at what is happening in the effective theory, which is obtained by doing the kind of thing that you are saying, then in fact, these green lines up here are exactly the trajectory to the effective theory. The effective theory is extremely good all the way up to including the bounds. It's very good everywhere. And so that's the reason why one could just use effective theory. But I would like to also understand at a more fundamental level, at full quantum gravity level, as to, you know, why these solutions are non-singular, and then the explanation is along the lines that I was telling Rob about the fact this flux lies repair each other. But at the effective level, you're right.
Okay, Isabel and John.
So it's a bit on the side, but I was wondering, does loop quantum cosmology give us any hint as to the nature of inflation in the atomic summary of that?
So two points. One is that two distinct remarks I'm making. First is really not answering directly your question, but I'm just telling you what happens with inflation. So what happens with inflation is that you can, usually we start with inflationary potential, and then the potential rolls down the potential. But I can start up here, the initial data that one gives me, Planck mass, and then I just want to evolve backward in time. Of course, if you evolve backward in time, classical equations will give you that there is actually a singularity. And if you can use it, so this is what Perlm and Thomas Pallas can have been basically doing. And the statement is that in this case, in fact, the singularity is resolved. So this is compatible completely with the inflationary potential, but we put the inflationary potential by hand and the photon by hand, and we give the parameters, which are sort of phenomenological parameters, to make the calculation concrete and see what happens. Now your next question is really about, can we go deeper and somehow think that inflaton has something to do, has some natural origin? And the thing is that, I don't know the answer, so this is speculation now. Recently, a couple of students at Penn State did very nice work in which they actually started with, there is this parameter in loop quantum gravity is called the Barberi inertia parameter, and its value is fixed, etc. But then the idea was that I always felt that, well, what happens if we make it a dynamical field? And maybe its value is fixed because of some dynamical principle later on. Now, they're not there yet. But on the other hand, what they can do is they can make it dynamic and then see what happens. And surprisingly, that system is completely equivalent to general relativity with the scalar field. So it could be that one could, that the inflaton, this is why I just want to say right away, this nothing has been worked out. But I think it's an interesting idea, intriguing idea, and I would like somebody, me or somebody, to follow it up. Namely, what happens if we use the Barberi inertia field, which is anyway coming out of class, it's there, as the kind of in place of the inflaton field. So there is one window there. Unlike string theory, because we don't have higher dimensions, we don't have plethora of.
There is another route to non-singular cosmology and gravitational collapse. And that's, there exists a modified classical modification of Einstein gravity. This is a bounce, t equals zero. Density is always positive as you go through the bounce. You need some negative pressure, t equals zero. And it gets rid of the singularity without quantum gravity.
Right. So one can invent quantum theories, and I'm agreeing with you. One can invent theories in which this happens, but to me at least, the non-trivial point here was just that this theory was there, this full general relativity, non-permittivity condensation, and applied to some cosmological context, and then it turned out that it had this repulsive force. Now I understand its origin, but of course, a priori, nobody had dreamt that this would be strong enough to actually cause the bounce and resolve the singularity. So the fact here is that it was not something that was classically, put in by saying that here is my new theory. This is a theory that we're just looking at quantum version of already general relativity. So that is the only point here. And here, of course, if you look at the real matter field, the real matter field has no negative pressure. The real matter field has this really is coming from quantum. The negative pressure is of quantum geometry origin. The matter field is a scalar field, it's massless scalar field. Rho is always equal to P, and both rho and P are positive. It really is stiff fluid. There's a difference between what you were just saying and this situation.
Yeah, because eventually, experiments should decide between modified and Einstein.
Like
it all gets down to that in the end.
Two last quick questions. More than two.
This is repulsive force that we talked about play a role in the formation of black hole.
So what is the general picture or what is that? So general picture is like this. So the statement is the following, that when you talk about black hole, collapse to a black hole, there are two issues. What do you mean by black hole, I guess is the question. The first thing is that one might ask, is it true that there are trapped surfaces? And in this kind of geometry scenario, there are trapped surfaces, just no problem at all, because typically trapped surfaces are formed where the curve is extremely low compared to Planck scale. Generally, if it is perfectly fine, there's no problem at all. Second question is, second point that one might think about is that black hole is really the singularity in the center. No, so in this case, there will be no singularity in the center, so in that sense, that black hole is not there. The third in-between thing is that, is there an event horizon in this picture? And the statement is that the notion of an event horizon is extremely global and theological notion. And for example, people like Peter Hajek have given examples in which you can take Schwarzschild black hole and some standard thing which collapses from the black hole and change the geometry back. Just change the geometry in the neighborhood, which is a Planck scale neighborhood of the singularity. And then you get a space-time for which there is no event horizon at all. And I think most people would like to think that they don't believe that a general relativity prediction in the Planck scale neighborhood of singularity is something that we should trust. So event horizons are extremely global and geological, and my personal, and the event horizons will disappear in the quantum gravity. My personal belief always is that even in classical general relativity, we shouldn't take them so very seriously. Okay, and the last thing is, so, yes, there are trapped surfaces, but there will be no singularity and no event horizons. Another question is how much of this actually has been shown. So very little, unfortunately. So in detail, people, I guess Modesto is here, and also other people, and Leonardo, and also other people have looked at just the interior of a Schwarzschild black hole and see if in fact the singularity is resolved. And the statement is that the singularity is resolved. But I also have written paper on that, but all papers, including mine, I feel are very inconclusive at this stage. They have to be much, you know, done in a much more complete manner. And so at this stage, I do not have a full answer, but I would be surprised if the qualitative picture that the singularity is resolved is not borne out finally. So I do expect that the singularity will be resolved.
My question, we have one.
Yes. You mentioned that you get the Busso bound to hold. If you require this bound to hold just barely, do you have to use the same emissive parameter as you do to reproduce the black hole entropy results?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Friedman-Robertson work model, this by Busso would be one quarter, 0.25. It turns out to be the maximum value is 0.2244 something. And the gamma that is used is the
I think that I know there are many more questions, but Abhay will be talking about black hole singularities tomorrow. The Lebanese here the rest of today and much of tomorrow, and so he's available for conversation, so let's thank him.